Hello, and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage, episode number 20, brought to you by Chaos Group. I want to make a couple of announcements before we get started on this podcast. We will be at FMX in Stuttgart, which is from May 5th to May 8th, so coming right up. We will be there. We have a booth, booth 1.3. I will also be presenting the WikiHuman project, which will be on May 7th. So please stop by and check it out. This episode features Eric Hansen, who I have known for many years, but I actually haven't seen him in a long time, so it was mostly us just catching up. Eric is an extremely important person for me in terms of being the person that really helped me get into visual effects. He gave me a lot of advice and sort of helped me make that transition from architecture to VFX, and we talk a little bit about that as well. We did this recording in his office, X-Res, which is in Santa Monica, and it was really cool to be there and see all that stuff. He showed me all the amazing stuff they do there. They do a lot of extremely high-res photography, gigapixel stuff, and they do a bunch of VR work with it as well, and photogrammetry, and lots of interesting, unique projects. So it was really cool to see that. In fact, Eric will also be presenting at FMX, so go check out his stuff as well. All right, guys, thanks a lot.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Well, let's start with that. Start talking about that. Yeah. For those who are listening, Eric just showed me his... let's call it a demo reel, right?
It is a demo reel.
It's a demo reel.
A VR reel.
And a VR reel, which is pretty awesome. I've known what you've done for a while, and now everything you've done makes sense on that equipment. It's you being able to experience what you've done and then put it on a virtual headset, and like, that's perfect. And the fact you can just say, here you go, just literally take your phone, put it into the headset, and like, here you go.
Well, when VR really got going, it was just obvious. It was just a natural fit for us. I mean, it just fit like a glove. So
right.
all the techniques we've been developing over the years apply. So it was just like, oh, clearly this is what we're doing.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to get into what you're doing and what X-Res is, and also I want to talk a little bit about FMX, which is coming up, and what you're going to be doing there.
Yeah, that's right.
But before that even starts, we should mention to people that we have a little bit of a history.
Yeah. Mostly good.
Mostly good. We've actually been you were probably the person, the most influential person to bring me into doing what I'm doing now. Into getting into visual effects.
I'll take the credit, but I will not take the blame.
There's some blame too, but definitely one of the most influential people that I got involved with. And this is back when I was still in architecture school, mm-hmm. and I contacted you.
Yeah, you did.
And you were the only person that sort of responded back, which was cool.
That was my first mistake then.
Yeah. But you were very welcoming and like, no, yeah, that's cool. You know, and you told me about what you have done and that you also used to be an architect, which is funny because almost everyone I've put on this podcast seems to have some kind of an architectural background.
Well, do they all say they're recovering architects or?
Recovering architects? Well, I had an interview with Ben West, who I'll probably post after this one, but he'd mentioned that, just like I think, that the architectural education was the best part of the whole process.
No, it's undeniable.
Yeah. So the architectural education is a good foundation for learning creative and creative feedback and criticism, mm-hmm. and all those things.
Oh, yeah.
So, but at the time when I first was hanging out with you, I think you were still working at Digital Domain. Were you working at Digital Domain? No, you were at Sony.
I don't know. That's going to, I had left Gensler at that.
You had
that
left point? Gensler, right. And okay. you had told me about Gensler, and I end up going to Gensler out of architecture school, which I really enjoyed. And you had been at Gensler, right?
So and you had followed Mark Leffitz, right? Because Mark, I set Mark up there.
Mark Leffitz was
on my exit,
right? At in the Santa Monica office at the time.
Yeah, that's right.
And then you were at the Santa Monica office before him.
Oh yeah.
And you'd left to go work on Fifth Element. No.
I worked on Special Venue for a year with a company called Simex, Simulation Experience.
Okay.
Out in Agoura Hills. And they had, it was actually a bunch of really awesome Alias artists. So that's where I kind of really kept my teeth on Alias. But as you may recall, I brought Alias into Gensler.
Oh, right.
And, you know, I'll tell you two kind of funny stories. One had to do with when I was at Gensler. Gensler had done all the renovation of all the movie studios, the studio lots in L.A., Warner and MGM, which became Sony. Mm-hmm. And but in any case, we had the head of Warner in one day. And, of course, because I did animation at that time, it was always the thing to show, you know, any brass that walked in the door. So the head of Warner Brothers sat down and, you know, we showed him this reel that we had put together for the Sony renovation. And I had placed some, you know, kind of 30s era Hollywood stars as cards in there and gave it kind of used a Benny Goodman track and all this type of thing. And it was so fun because he was watching it and then he turns to me and he's this big, heavy guy. Kind of like, I'm kind of envisioning him holding a cigar. I'm not sure if he was, but he turns to me and he goes, "Son, you ought to be in the movies." And he was right. I mean, it kind of like did plant a seed, I think. You know? So I kind of thought, well, maybe. And then, of course, CGI was just starting on its, you know, upward path at that time in film. And I realized that nobody had done environments. All it was characters at that point. The Mask had come out. Jurassic, of course, had just come out. And it was nothing but creatures and characters. I thought, where's the cities? Where's the environments here?
Right. You know?
So that was my big motivation. And let's see, I'm going to... and the other funny story about that is ILM had seen some of my renders I was doing at Gensler, and they called me up and they said, "How would you like to, have you ever thought about working in film?"
Uh-huh.
And I said, no, well, not really, but I'd love to talk to you. So they flew me, I forget where I was, if I was in Seattle or LA.
I remember this story, yeah.
Yeah, they flew me to ILM back in the day. And I had been, I think a friend of mine, Cody Harrington, had showed me Boss Effects back in the day.
Right.
He was on Abyss and all this. So I knew a little bit about effects, but not a lot. And so I go into, you know, Lucas's officer, ILM, rather, when they were in Marin. And, you know, architects dress nice. And I thought, well, you know, I knew about ILM. That's, you know, they're top of the pyramid. I guess I should probably look good.
Yeah.
So I had a little sport jacket and, you know, nice architectural, you know.
Yeah, you kind of almost
get up
almost
on.
Wore a suit. Pretty much.
Well, pretty much did. Yeah. In other words. And I was greeted at the door by Sean Schurer, who I think is still around. I think he's a Pixar. I'm not sure. But Sean, I'm not sure if he still dresses the same way. But back then, he had a black leather biker jacket with circuit boards sewn all over it. And then he had a big black, you know, slick back ponytail and a little goss style. And then he had a woman's black lacy skirt and then big giant army boots. And, you know, if you could have taken a picture of me and him, it would have been classic.
Yeah.
And my first words to him was, "I think I overdressed for this event."
Yep.
So it was my first view at visual effects culture.
Yeah.
But not that we all dress that way, but it was but it showed that I really did not understand the culture back then.
Right.
And that's such a key thing is because you were one of, I think, several that I kind of gave cheap advice to coming over from architecture into film. And that's always been my first motto is know your audience. You know? And, you know, so anyway, but
I remember the first time you told me that story is we saw this very young guy walking out of DD and he had a suit on. And we're like, oh boy, I bet you his mom told him to dress up for the interview. And I remember like not long after that, when I started to work in VFX and I had a career change, then my mom decided she would come visit me and she, she showed up and at DD and like she met Andy Weisler.
Oh yeah,
you know, he was our boss, right? And he's like, oh hi, how you doing? He had like a t-shirt on with like coffee stains on it, flip flops and shorts, and she's like, oh my god, you know, she's from the Northeast where you know you have to wear a suit every day to go to work. Yeah, right. And he's like, are you okay? I mean, like, are you making enough money? He's like, I'm fine. Probably, yeah, I'm fine. So it was hard for people to understand, like, you know, that. But the irony now is that in Los Angeles, if you see anyone wearing a suit, they're a salesman of some kind. They're selling you a mattress. You know?
Well, it's also what they say. Like, if you see somebody walking in L.A., people pull over and ask them if they're okay.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of true. It's like, you know, nobody walks here. So
right.
Similar kind of thing. But that's one thing. I do a lot in education and teaching my students, that's my 101 advice is, you know your audience, know the culture.
Yeah.
Go on to cinefx.com, see the upcoming films, see what shops, what individuals are doing them, look up their profiles in IMDb, understand, you know, that who you're going to talk to and position yourself as one of them, not as an outsider.
Right.
So, and that's the number one thing. And, you know, I think effects is maybe a little easier to get into now, but back then it was definitely, there was a big bouncer at the door, as I always said.
Yeah.
It was like a barnyard dance that had a big bouncer, and it was like how you got past that bouncer. So, that's one of the main things that kind of helps.
Yeah, I mentioned that story. You told me that exact story as well, and it was, you know, when you'd call me, I mean, you'd call me and basically say, hey, you know, we're going to build all of New York City for Day After Tomorrow. Do you want to come over? It would be good timing for you to come over to DD. And I said, okay. So I was ready to do the jump. But it would not have been for you to go to the gigantic stack of VHS tapes and just pull one out and say, check this out.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only way it works now, you know?
Yeah, right.
So
Send half inch anymore, by the way.
Yeah, no, don't. Actually, no, it was funny because the podcast with John Litt, he'd mentioned how he wanted to do like a Kickstarter or some kind of thing for Think Geek would be like a VHS tape thing where you put your demo reel on it. But when you flip it open, it's actually a screen that's with your demo reel playing on it.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
But so if you show up to an interview with like a VHS tape.
Yeah, it might be a little too much though. I think I remember getting an application once and it was filled with confetti. And that's one way to piss off an HR division because it got all over the place. And it was like, who the hell did this? You know, it's like, don't send confetti in your resume.
Yeah.
But... Yeah. So you don't need the gimmicks.
No gimmicks. So you had worked at Gensler. You were doing stuff. You brought in some Alias stuff, and then you had eventually moved over to film, right? So
yeah, I took that. Well, basically, what happened was I've always been enamored with 3D, and I think when I graduated in '86 at UT Austin, the Mac, the vanilla Mac, the first Mac had just come out. And there was a little program called Mac Space, and my brother has been an evangelist at Apple his whole life.
Right.
And was there.
He worked
at the time.
At Apple, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah, he just retired after 26 something years.
Wow. And, okay.
So he's always like showered me with Apple gear. So he dropped a Mac on me, and he said, "Oh, here's some program. I don't know what this is, but you can fool with it." And it was Mac Space, which, to my knowledge, is one of the very first early commercial 3D packages. And I was, of course, having to lay out perspective manually at that time in architecture. And here's something that you just model some form and boom, instant perspective. And I thought that was the cat's meow. So I did that to kind of help my final project. And it was so funny because my jury for that, one of the professors were like, and Eric here actually used a computer to help him do his presentation, it was a novel thing.
Yeah.
But shortly thereafter, I just felt the buzz about it, and I ended up working for Callison Partnership in Seattle, who had big Intergraph boxes at that day.
Oh right.
And they were these giant, like, you know, truck size. They had a big digitizing tablet and a couple monitors on them, and they had a 3D. This is MicroStation, and they had MicroStation at that time was really adept at 3D modeling. And then they had a little rendering package called Model View, and I ended up just embracing it you know, up and down. So I just thought this was the best thing ever. So a lot of my design work, as I was starting off my architectural career, I would use that to do design and presentation.
Right.
And then within these couple firms, Gensler and Callison, they both had Intergraph. They were both Intergraph based at that time. And I became a bit of a poster boy for rendering and all that. And I remember Intergraph brought me out to their conferences, which was largely a bunch of engineers. And of course, I was doing art, you know, artful rendering with it. So I was a bit of an anomaly and kind of like an exotic pet or something for them. So, I think I just was wildly enamored of 3D rendering from the get-go. Mm-hmm. And I did that. Of course, I built up studios at Callison and Gensler just to do that as a studio concentration within the firm. And that's due to a good friend of mine, Joe Cordell, who urged me that, you know, I should kind of derail off the traditional pathway and forge my own and try to do this as a new thing in architecture, which I did. So it was, so that was fun. And then, but it, I think it all kind of came to a head. This is why I was chuckling a second ago, because what drove me out was having to render an Arby's drive-in at Gensler. And I had done some pretty nice work. And then it came down to, like, you know, just the good jobs weren't coming in. And it was like, you know, now we want you to render an Arby's. And it just, at that point, you know, I saw what was happening in film or beginning to happen. And it just, like, this is where history is going to be made. Mm-hmm. So I did that jump, and that, you know, and it proved, you know, I never look back, would always do that again. So it's always been a great, great path and great career. But that's kind of how it happened. And I think part of it is also, I like the freedom the film afforded me. One thing about architecture I did not like was the fact that you're kind of expected to go down a certain pathway. The rails were laid out in front of you,
right,
as you went. And I just really resented that. And
And
I know that
pathway
that's not
is
the case.
It's like a 15 to 20 year pathway.
Yeah, yeah. And working for these big firms, I saw too many old guys, to be honest, that, you know, I didn't want to become one of. So it was kind of, I needed.
Your future was right in front of you.
I was more opportunistic. And right. I wanted to, and I'm, and to this day, what we do in my little office here is we, you know, we're just totally motivated by innovation. So that hadn't gone away. So that's always been a central motivator for me.
Right. Well, I think there was when you first talking about it, I actually now remember what it was, is I was talking to someone that happened to be a contact through my mother that says, oh, she's got a niece that works at DreamWorks or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so I got in touch with her, and she said, oh, you're an architect. You're interested in 3D. I know the perfect person that you need to talk to, and this guy's name is Eric Hansen. He is Mr. Environments, Mr. CG Environments. And that was what she told me about you. And that's how I got your email.
Oh, interesting.
So
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and that's what happened, I think. And then we ended up chatting, and then you're just like, oh, you lived in Houston. I lived in Houston. And then, you know, you knew each other from all these different separations. So it was actually kind of cool. I'm kind of joking about it because I've become very – well, you know, integrated in the industry. I know a lot of different people. But Gina keeps joking about it. She's our marketing director in our office, and she keeps joking about it. She calls it 6 degrees of Chris Nichols. Like, oh, there's blah, blah, blah. And it's like, oh, I'm nothing. You should see, like, I learned from the master. That's Eric Hansen. He knows everybody. You know, you've been doing this for a long time, and you've managed to just make all these connections with all these people for many years. Right?
Mm-hmm. That's a great aspect. And this is true for architecture. It's true for anything, is that ultimately your career is about the social networking and kind of the social interactions that you have. The work is always there, and, you know, you'll always be immersed in that. But it's really the people, I remember in architecture school, they always talk about great clients, and it is true. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the nature of who you work for and with is pretty central to your experience in your career. It's not, I mean, the work is definitely satisfying, but the technical aspect, but the social scene, and just to kind of see where it's going to go. And that's one thing that I love about visual effects and film or graphics, is that there are no tracks laid down. In our company, it's like I always say, when people ask me to describe X-Res, it's a very daunting thing to describe in a sentence or less.
Sure.
Because we don't do the same project ever twice. We really don't have repeat clients ever, and that's not because people aren't you know, satisfied. They love what we do, but it's just they're oddball projects. They're one of a kind.
I've got this crazy idea.
Strange projects. Yeah. And we were just, you know, lucky and thrilled to be able to work on what we do. But it's, but again, so it's the Ouija board of fate that I love about, you know, graphics and VFX. And that's, you know, I don't mean to say that doesn't happen in architecture. I'm sure it does, but it just feels like especially unknown, I think, when you work in this field.
Right. Yeah. I definitely feel that the one thing I sort of always motivated me about VFX in a way, and unfortunately it's not as true as it used to be, but part of what makes a VFX something that's interesting visual effects is that it's something you've never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
So that by definition, you have to do something no one's ever done before.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always, you always have to break new ground. Like every
right.
show
yeah.
you would start on,
yeah.
it's like, well, there's always a development phase because you're always going to have to develop something that you've never been done before.
Mm-hmm.
So I've
yeah, and that's a bond that bonds everybody in the field.
Yeah,
as opposed to,
and that's why everyone wants to get on a film at the beginning because they want to be involved in that creative juice that happens right at
yeah.
the beginning.
In architecture, there's some of that, but there's so much like if you do specs or whatever you do, you know, it's kind of
or an Arby's drive-thru.
Yeah, Arby's. You can apply it to the same project over and over and over again.
Right,
and you know, so I just kind of saw it as a bit of a hamster wheel, but you know, I know if you're close to design, obviously in architecture, it's still a great adventure. Don't get me wrong,
and right.
not to knock any of it, but it's but I find the path that I chose especially liberating and enjoyable in that way.
Yeah, it was funny. There was a quote today that someone gave me from Frank Gehry that he said 97% of the architecture out there is crap.
Oh, I saw that.
You
yeah.
saw that? And I was like, well, of course it is, because for like every, you know, Disney concert hall, there's like a million Taco Bells that have to be built too.
Yeah.
You know?
I think his language is stronger than that, but
I think
I
he
forget.
Said shit.
Yeah, something like
yeah,
that.
Which is fine. We can curse on here.
Oh, sure. Heck yeah.
So anyway, the yeah, so that was cool. So I started off on Day After Tomorrow. That was the first show, and I was working with you directly, and it was kind of fun because
mm-hmm.
I kind of went right into architecture right over. Right, okay.
Yeah, you didn't escape too much.
Didn't escape, but I was very, very paranoid at the time about like not knowing how if I was going to do a good job, how to work in feature films.
Yeah, I remember you were a little anxious, actually.
Yeah,
I
very
that.
Anxious. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting about you is that you were like you were such a strong NURBS modeler that it was your first foray into polygonal modeling.
I'm a NURBS loyalist, yeah. is what I say.
So, and I was like, how do you build buildings with NURBS? And you're like, no, this is what I've always done. I was like, look at the...
I still swear that I could make a more efficient NURBS model than a poly model. It doesn't make any sense to anybody, but I have techniques that do make sense, and I still believe that's true.
Okay.
You know, because you don't build in planes and polys, right? You build in volumes mostly, right?
Right?
Yeah, but
well, you can
I was
build
like
in planes, absolutely.
Well, you can, but it's not the normal workflow. So I'm just saying, it's like, I mean, my whole shtick was based on this kind of like if you built a chipboard model, you know, it was like
right.
this really efficient, and I could get my models lower polygon than a poly model, you
right.
know, and it's like wait a minute, it's NURBS. No. It's if you adhere, and to be honest, that's what got me notice or you know, or got me some success early on was being able to render a degree of detail that nobody had seen much of outside of characters, of course,
right?
Because they hadn't seen it, or they couldn't build it. There were so many failed attempts at doing cityscapes that were
well,
just
was the
way
first,
bloated.
The first big one that you did that is very memorable is probably Fifth Element, right?
Well, I did a big one for this ride film before that, which never got, and it was, you know, it wasn't distributed in any way, but it was at CIMAX was this giant cityscape, kind of a futuristic Tokyo, and it was, that's where I kind of, again, cut my teeth. And again, it was at that time, and that got me in the door at DD in a heartbeat. I mean, I whipped out renders on that, and they just said, oh, well, okay, you know, when can you start?
Right.
So one thing leads to another, but that, but again, that was from being able to render a lot of detail
right.
and lighting, you know, to try to get, you know, a little bit more GI looking lighting out of direct lighting back
yep.
then. And that was the other thing. So, but yeah, no, I still, you know, I still sing the praises of NURBS to my students, believe it or not. You know, and the fact is, you know, in Maya especially, you can hit a NURBS, any NURBS command outputs polys. It's not like in a sense, they're just more poly tools.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, I mean, and there's still nothing like birail and polys, right? But you could say there's nothing like, you know, certain sub-D things in NURBS. But the fact is,
to be honest, modeling has evolved so much these days that I don't even know anymore.
Because I kind of moved out of it.
ZBrush and all those things are going out there.
Yeah,
and like
that's
even
right.
even
that's
even right. you know what people are doing with in SketchUp and stuff. I was like, I don't even know. You know, mm-hmm. and Modo is just amazing as a modeling package.
Yeah,
as well.
I understand.
So. Yeah.
I get people to build my models now.
Yeah.
I'm kind of like, I've
been doing that for the last 10 years probably. But the other thing that was, you know, pretty funny is I remember Fifth Element. Like, oh, that cityscape was really, really memorable. And I think that was sort of, just to put things in perspective, you built this very futuristic city for Fifth Element. It was a big deal. And it was, let's see. How much RAM did you have on those machines back then? Like 256 megs of RAM?
Oh, way less.
Really?
Way less. Are you kidding?
A meg.
No, that was you know, SGI Extreme days.
Oh, wow.
So those were, I don't know what was standard, but it was, yeah, it was tiny, whatever it was.
So teeny amounts of RAM, right?
Yeah, I don't even remember now, but yeah, I mean, 16 was probably, you know, luxurious or something.
16 megs of RAM.
I'm sure.
Yeah. And you were able to build all of that on 16 megs of RAM.
Yeah. But again, I was pulling all kinds of tricks.
Of course. That's fine. But that's the point, is that that's how long.
And as a matter of fact, it's funny because I had seen and still to this day see people present and they boast of long render times. And it's like, it's not something to boast about.
No.
It was like, it's a badge of honor that, you know, we rendered this incredible amount of, you know, cycles for these renders. And it's like, no. So I always had
They boast about it on Gravity. And I'm like,
yeah,
I don't
sure.
see why you would want to talk about it. Look beautiful. There's no question about that. No. But
yeah, it's a different animal today. But back then I think I had a rule that if the renders were, you know, and you know, about, Blinn's law, right, of rendering. You've heard that. It's like the CPU, you know, processing power increases exponentially, render times stay flat.
Right.
And so it really is, back then, it's kind of the same as today.
So it was 2 hours a frame.
Well, yeah, back then it was like an hour. But I always felt like if it was more than 45 minutes, I'm doing something wrong.
Right.
And I'd reattack it, and I'd get it back down again. And it would be just the same. So, you know, I've always kind of adhered to that. And today, with what we're doing more in photogrammetry where everything's baked. So it's, you know, now I got really fast render times.
Mm-hmm.
But because we're relying more on real-world subjects. But nonetheless, it's actually, the battles are still kind of maybe the same. But I think people have gotten, I don't know, I wonder about that. I wonder about all my little, you know, obsession with optimization may not really hold today anymore, you know. Because all the modern renderers just chew through polys like nothing. So,
yeah, they do, but there's still long render times. I mean, people, you know, especially with ray tracers.
Yeah, sure.
You can do
one
button click can make your render time 50 hours. You know,
yeah.
If you accidentally do
something. Optimizing rays more than you are polys.
Right.
That's what it is.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Billions of polygons are no longer a problem for nearly any rendering engine anymore.
Yeah.
And you know, especially things like proxies and instance rendering and all that.
But
stuff.
The funny thing is, I mean, I've gone through a few of these bellwether shifts in the industry. I left, I forget what feature that was, but I left features for a year to work on this real-time project up in San Francisco.
Oh, I remember that. What was the name of that company?
Zulu.
Zulu, that's right.
A very oddball little enterprise, and that, but that was to develop a 6 degree of freedom, like flight simulators. They wanted to put 24 of them in this venue in the Metreon in San Francisco. And I came in as like the art director and creative director on it for the realization of this big futuristic alien world you'd fly into. And it was a lot of fun. But anyway, so I left kind of, you know, features behind. I came back a year later and HDRs had taken over. And I start dropping in some direct lights. Like, what are you doing? You know, I'm like, well, lighting, you know. No, just put this HDR in, you know. Right. And I mean, HDR had been around, but it took over overnight while I was out.
Right.
And came back. And then, of course, the death of NURBS was another one. And, you know, it's funny. It's like things, you know, there are these little shifts that happen.
It still happens. And then HDRs were happening as well. but
and ray tracing. I mean, the ray tracing.
Yeah, but I mean, still, I remember very specifically, even when we were on iRobot as an example, when we were lighting a robot, because there was no GI or there wasn't any proper ways of doing things, we basically still lit the robots with like 20 spotlights. We'd have an HDR,
yeah,
and then we'd light it with like 20 spotlights, and mm-hmm. there would be all these weird things because you'd use a spotlight to mimic a bounce of light, right?
Yeah,
for spec or whatever mm-hmm. else. And so it was always this, you know, this thing you had to do. And then now, and you know, as you take it a few years forward, when we were working on what was it, Real Steel, another robot movie, right? And there was this guy who was lighting something, and he had like 25 spotlights on the robot. And I'm like, what are you doing? He goes, I'm trying to light it. And it was taking forever. He's like moving a little speck here, and then he'd have like light attached to one part of it. It was just so convoluted lighting. And I was like, what's going on? And then I said, well, Chris, you want to give him a hand? Maybe you can show him what you do to light the shot. I said, no problem. So I went over. I was like, here's what they lit it on set. Here's they used one big area light there and one big area light there, and that's all they used. So I was like, HDR, two area lights, and it should look perfect. And it did. Because that's the thing now. It's like you're lighting with real lights now.
Yeah, you know? That's right.
So it just looks very, very, you know, you can pretty much get your lighting done. And in my mind, you can get your lighting done in 5 minutes, the same way that it would take a DP to light it. And if you're already looking what the DP already did, then you should be able to match that pretty quickly. So, yeah, it was interesting back then. We did have to do a lot more work to get the look right. But that was a good skill to have, you know? That was a good skill to have. And it was a lot more like painting in a sense, because your spotlights were paint brushes in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you were at DD for a while. You obviously went to Sony for a little bit as well, right?
Oh, made rounds. I think I worked most houses except for Rhythm.
Right.
And Greg, my business partner here, spent a few years at Rhythm, so we kind of got most of the houses covered.
Most of the houses covered.
At least in L.A.
Right. And then you went back to DD when I was there, and we worked on the Day After Tomorrow together, and it Stealth, too, a little bit, right?
A little bit, right at the beginning. Yeah.
Right. And then what were you doing after that?
Oh, you know, I think that's when... I'm guessing, and I could be wrong, I think that's when Alex Alvarez over at Noman said, why don't you help me redo our DVD library?
Right.
And that's when, and you, of course, participated in that.
Yeah.
And I roped you in on that. And so I think I took about a year off and hung out with Alex at his place. And we, you know, he had been doing DVDs for a while, and they were kind of...
So you were helping produce these things. You were producing.
Yeah, I came on as like exec producer or something like that. You know, basically just kind of overhauled what
he had done. Brought in a lot of talented people to bring.
Yeah, so that's kind of what I brought to the table was a little Rolodex of great artists and you know who I'd worked with. And so I, you know, he had done some kind of I think they were kind of VHS level or I forget what, but basically we contemporized the whole thing, brought it up to modern DVD standards at that time. And then I think I created or managed and produced 33. And then four of those were my own titles on sets and environments. And then the others were other people's that I helped them produce for the library, of which yours, I think, were number one for a long time.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was the only thing you could get on V-Ray.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Which was funny. Yeah, they were the only DVDs that you can get on V-Ray, and they were kind of out of date but still selling. Because I think at the time, as an example, there was no dome light when I first did those.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so the way to do HDRs was to do it as a GI light. Or is it environment GI light? And then you'd have to say basically use GI. But when the dome light came on board, you basically, there was a lot of times you can just
got to get in there and update them now, Chris.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Those were interesting times making those DVDs, because I remember that the biggest challenge was actually just making the content to make the DVDs and then the recording of it itself.
Yeah, that's right. We all wanted to. The trick about that compared to other. Training was that, you know, we wanted, it basically was, and you know, so, like, great artists do not always make great instructors,
right,
is the trick I learned about that. And the way we looked at it, Alex and I both looked at it, was that you're paying to sit over the shoulder of a skilled artist for a few hours. Mm-hmm. And, you know, yeah, he may not deliver, you know, he may not be the most concise or eloquent speaker, but if you're able to kind of investigate their workflow and see what they go through in their process to create their art at a high level, then it was worth the paltry $70 or whatever it was.
Right.
So as opposed to like a 101 training from other vendors that, you know, it's not about the artist. It's just about getting somebody to tell you what this command does.
Push this button, do this
thing. Yeah, which is fine. And that serves a perfect role too. But to be honest, that's what I think. But Noman was kind of in this, you know, the school was 101 stuff.
Right.
To a large degree. But at the same time, it was also master-based stuff too. And the DVDs were, you know, were kind of seen as that. Although some of them we tried to make as kind of 101 entry, like Meets ZBrush titles were kind of the first kind of ZBrush instruction, I think.
Right.
That was out there back then. But in any case, yeah, that was good. It was good fun. Did that for about a year. And then I think I had bumped into Greg Downing at that point, and that's actually I think I met him over in Copenhagen at a festival.
Yep.
And enlisted him to do some on panoramic shooting and
well, you had always had an interest in doing. Let me also say, like Eric, and I've always known Eric as a big outdoor person.
Oh, sure.
Loved hiking, doing outdoor stuff, taking camera gear out there, doing all kinds of stuff, and so it's one of those things where you think it's like, oh, well, I love going outdoor and going hiking. How can I turn that into a job?
Well, that was what X-Rays was about.
Yeah.
But it took me a long time to figure that out.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was, I always had, because I was a fairly advanced hang glider pilot for about 22 years.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
So I taught, that's actually my teaching originated with that. And I flew a little bit of competition. I was a dealer, but I taught, I was in Austin, Texas. I was one of the main instructors for several years, and that's actually kind of what drew me out to California, to be honest.
Just hang gliding?
It was a lot of hang gliding, yeah, because I read the magazine. It's all California flying, you know, so, you know, this is like I daydream about it in my college classes all
But then you
long.
Do it out of New Mexico, too? In
oh, yeah, oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah, Sandia Peak. Oh, yeah, I had incredible things. But so this was kind of, you know, a big passion of mine for a long time, and but, you know, was kind of coupled or contrasted by sitting in a chair for long hours, you know, pushing a mouse around. So it's mm-hmm. like, it's just this totally contrasting existence.
Mm-hmm.
And, but in any case, you know, career, middle age, marriage, kids conspires against solitary pursuits like hang gliding, which in effect are fantastic, but ultimately selfish. So yeah. I kind of hung the hat up on that.
That was that. I remember Kara telling me like the thing that she'd like, you go hang gliding with her and she'd like drive the car around, drop you off. And you're like, drive the car around, pick you up, and like, I did nothing, and you're like, yeah, that was awesome! And it's like, yeah, that's the, we're done with this.
Yeah, yeah. I think I yelled down, I love you, a few times, and it's like, thinking that would make it all better, but it didn't. No, the problem is, Carrie, you know, I married a very intelligent woman, so it was, you know, a lot of hang glider pilots don't, and they do that because they just want somebody to drive their vehicle and have the warm, you know, the cold beer ready and all that stuff.
Yeah.
but yeah, so I, but anyway, but you're right. The outdoors has always been a huge passion. And then, so anyway, but yeah, so I did this kind of, I had this bilateral kind of life, you know, of, you know, urban CGI and outdoor pursuits. But anyway, so, and that kind of continued, but nonetheless, yeah, I think after the Noman thing, just to tie this back into this little timeline that you're going on, then I hooked up with Greg Downing, kindred spirit in all this, and he had a lot of skills and aptitude for spherical photography, which I had dabbled in. We both did, actually. If
yeah,
you remember,
you're right. Yep.
We went to Death Valley once, and you were actually shooting HDRs before I was,
yeah.
If I recall correctly. You had that little Nikon fisheye camera. And, but anyway, so we, yeah, but Greg and I just hit it off and we started talking about interesting things to do with kind of combining photography and CGI. And, and we, at that time, what got us started, we didn't know it was going to become a company. It was just kind of like, you know, buddies doing cool stuff together. Excuses, basically, for getting into the outdoors.
Yeah.
Is what it was. But we started figuring we could kind of combine some CGI with outdoor pursuits. And that was the key. But but anyway, at that time, gigapixel photography had arrived on the scene as an academic exercise. And somebody in the Netherlands had developed a little robotic head to do the fine divisions required of shooting a series of mosaics of what was in effect a parking lot on a campus, and it was world's biggest image of the world's most boring subject. So Greg and I looked at this and went, wait a minute, you know, we could take the reins on that and start to capture something really worthy.
Right.
So we went up to Yosemite, I think, right away, and he had appropriated some gear, worked with Peace River Studios out of Boston. Some guys have made some really nice kind of motion control gear, and they had a pan tilt head that was programmable, unlike many that were joystick or other. And so they lent us one of their early devices called the Pixorb, and it was, again, a way you could program a camera shooting in increments and in shuttering. So we wrote our own scripts. We worked it all out in Maya, actually. We did all the camera work, kind of the overlaps and the programming of what we wanted the unit to do in Maya, which made it really easy, because before that, everybody was using these panoramic calculators, and there's no way to get an empirical feel for what goes on with that. Whereas working in 3D, which most panoramic photographers do not do, we kind of had an advantage there. So we could kind of previs all this stuff in Maya. So we did that, and then we went out to, enjoy the work of Ansel Adams, and the Black Monolith is one of my favorite shots, which is the face of Half Dome, half in shadow. And that was his seminal work that he discovered abstraction in photography, was the Black Monolith. If you look at Ansel's work, his early work was actually not that inspired or abstract. It actually was kind of pedestrian. Mm-hmm. But when he put on a ratten red filter and brought the sky down to black and came up with his zone system and all that, he had this kind of watershed moment that was shooting this face of Half Dome from a place that's really hard to get to. It's not on a conventional trail. So I did research on all this, and then Greg, tech wizard that he is, wrote some way to capture the webcam at Yosemite, which looked beautifully at the face of Half Dome, and we like time-lapsed the webcam throughout the day, capturing it every half hour or something, and we found just the right, and we did this for months, and we found just the right moment where the shadow matched Ansel's photograph. And we knew what day to go back and do it.
Right.
So we went back, and I could have done this with ray tracing, to be honest, but,
might as well walk the webcam.
Might as well. So we did that. And anyway, long story short, we went up there with a group of guys, and it took a few weekends to finally figure out how to get to this place. And we lugged up tremendous load of gear, and it was just a crazy, kind of adventure.
You had a whole group of people, didn't you?
Well, ultimately, we had a massive group when we did the big project.
Oh, okay. So this is
Yep, yep. I think we called it the Half Dome Gigapixel Challenge or something like that back then. And but anyway, we got up to the same point that he shot, and it had the same shadow, and we did the first spherical gigapixel, I think, that's ever been made, to our knowledge. And so we shot a full sphere, but in gigapixel. And to this day, we still license and do things with that image all the time. It's like our workhorse image.
Really?
And it was just really terrific and a lot of fun. So that kind of got us thinking. And then we thought, well, we were environments guys. There's got to be a way to appropriate this for digital environments for film. And then we got into Greg had already, he helped develop Image Modeler for RealViz back in the day.
Okay.
He was on staff there in Nice, France, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so we thought, well, we could laser scan, we could do photogrammetry, and we could combine that with gigapixel, and we could combine it with terrain data, which, DEM data. And I did one of my DVDs at Noman all in this technique.
On DEM data, yeah.
So we all wove all that stuff together in an orchestrated way, and we're able to create very, very high resolution recreations of natural environments. And that's, in fact, all we've been doing now for 8 years at X-Res. But we find different projects to apply them to, and it's been just terrific to to kind of have a lot of fun with this. And we keep finding new ways. There's obviously photogrammetry's advanced hugely in the last 2 years and
sure,
you know, all this and that. So, and now of course with VR, it's all the merrier.
So I remember the follow-up to your Yosemite trip was the big Yosemite thing, right?
Yeah. And that's to date, that's still probably our finest or most historic project that we've done at this company. And what we did is we did that image of Half Dome, and then we got it online. Greg was the first one to put a terrestrial gigapixel image online, we believe. Mm-hmm. He reappropriated the Google Maps API. They came out with an open API. So mm-hmm. he just pointed to our image tiles rather than their map tiles mm-hmm. and put that up. And it was an internet sensation. It was like 7 years ago. And we front paged on Dig. We brought our ISP down and about 40 customers, and they kicked us out. They were furious, like, how dare you create this bandwidth? And I'm like, you're an ISP. You love this stuff. Right. What are you talking about? They're like, no, we can't handle you. Get out of here. And then we found somebody who did all the Vegas gambling sites, and they said, we can handle you. So that's nice. Lunar Pages, and they are a great partner now for years.
Lunar
but anyway,
Pages, right. Yeah.
Yeah, so they're terrific. So anyway, so we put the image up online, and it got all kinds of notice. And in doing so, it attracted somebody from the real estate sector who gave us our first big job, and that's when we launched the company. And that was to document 33 cities around the U.S. in gigapixel for Realtor.com. And,
wow. Okay.
So that was this big giant effort, and we hired 4 teams of photographers. We bought just a massive amount of Canon gear and motion control heads, and we canvassed the whole U.S. for 6 months.
Wow.
And did all these things. So we have this amazing repository of gigapixel images of the U.S. The funny thing about that, though, and actually this was related to SIGGRAPH, because I shot a gigapixel image at SIGGRAPH, and that's the one, now that I recall, that hit big, because people were looking for topless sunbathers on the rooftops.
Oh, really?
Looking down from the Prudential Tower in Boston, because everybody has those roof gardens. So there's this, it caused this voyeuristic, you know, interest online, I think. And of which there is one I will suggest if you ever look at this image, we did find, funny enough. But nonetheless, so that caused or created our company. And but anyway, back to Half Dome in Yosemite. We had this big image of Yosemite. Well, a rockfall occurred on the face of it, and it didn't kill anybody, but it was a big historic major rockfall. Greg Stock, who's a park geologist, saw our image. He had seen it, and then this rockfall occurred in the image, kind of in the same region that we shot. And he went back to re-photograph from that same position with the same lens of that area. And now he had a datum. He had a before and after of what fell. Mm-hmm. And he called us up totally excitedly, like, oh my, he goes, this is a major event for me, because now in my research, I have a datum, and now I can calculate mass of what fell, because his whole thing is release mechanics. It's like understanding how the fractures and faulting of a rock face, you know, how they fracture and cleave off. So he goes, well, now I have mass, and this is just a great, great thing. And can you do the whole valley for us? And, you know, it's an 8-mile long valley.
Right.
And I said, well, that sounds terrific. And I said, how much money do you have? How much funding do you have? And he said, none.
Yeah.
And I said, well, we work with a lot of great companies. And at that time, we were working with Microsoft really heavily. So I said, let me talk to some of our associates and see what we can do. So we got Canon, Microsoft, Google. We got Manfrotto, we just went down the list. We got a ton of people to support us on that project.
And at this point, you're going to do an 8-mile thing. You had to make a team of people to do this.
Oh yeah. So I went through I invited well-known photographers from around the world. We had guys coming out from all over, and then, and VFX people that knew a little bit of photography
but they could at least
run the range from pudgy individuals to trained athletes. And, mm-hmm. you know, and I kind of assigned people based on their fitness level and, you know, different hikes.
Right.
And then, and Yosemite's blessed with, you know, a huge amount of trails. So there's vantage points all over the place. Mm-hmm. So we did it, and it took a year to do this project, 6 months of planning, and then 45 minutes to take 10,000 images. So we got 20 teams. Each team had 3 or 4 people. There's 70 of us total.
And they all had to get to a certain point at exactly the right time.
And they all had the same gear. So LowPro gave us beautiful packs, and Canon cameras, and Google gave us the early gigapixel Japan.
Right.
And all these devices. And so we distributed the packs among teams. We sent them up the trail. We had radios, GPS, and at, I think it was 1 o'clock or 12 noon or something, high noon, I got on the radio and said, ready, shoot. And we captured, we shuttered 10,000 images in 45 minutes. And we documented 20 gigapixel panoramas all throughout the valley with the same temporal lighting.
Right.
And that I wanted that because, A, I didn't want to, you know, do this day after day. And, two, I wanted to make a unified model of the whole thing, which we ended up doing. And then, so anyway, and the whole thing was a raging success, and we had a great raging party that night.
But didn't you guys make like a, like once you stitched the whole thing together, you had like a 3D model completely projected.
Yeah. So the geologist, Greg Stock, had a 1 meter resolution LIDAR, flown by a light aircraft of the valley. And it was still one of the most phenomenal pieces of terrain data I've ever seen. And which I now think is publicly available, I'm pretty sure. But it's, if you go to, is it Open Topo? Not Open, well, I forget. But it, anyway, it is available. But it's an amazing bit of data. So we subpixel displaced that up. And ultimately, I think I don't forget where the mesh came from. This is pre-Mudbox. But anyway, we ended up with a terrific amount of geometry and then took all the 20 gigapixel panos and spherically projected each one with kind of an importance-driven mechanism. We custom-coded a lot of things. Mm-hmm. Patrick Palmer wrote a great slit-scan camera. Originally, I was going to slit-scan. It's the only existing slit scan camera in Maya. If any of you ever want to use it, contact me because
so basically it's still a camera that goes like a scanner.
Well, it's like a slit scan camera, and it's right. It's rather amazing. So if you make a pathway, it'll create an extruded strip of pixels like from a slit,
right?
Just like a slit scan. And I thought that would be the way to do it, is because of the contours of the valley, I could kind of weave in and out and kind of capture and expose
right.
things around corners and all that. Well, it ended up creating the most surrealistic, Dali-esque, bizarre image. So it wasn't really what we wanted. So we ended up rendering orthographic views of the north and the south side. We rendered them in mental ray at 150K. So we had a way to render out, you know, in layers. And then comped it up into this two massive images. And I think it's historic, though it's never gotten really any press to speak of, because it's the first image of nature devoid of perspective. So, and, you know, because it's orthographically represented. So it's the one view you can see all the monuments in Yosemite. And I love showing it to people that have never seen Yosemite, or that know Yosemite, rather, because they know there's nowhere to see all that. And they get really confused because they're looking at a photograph, yet there's something odd about it. So it's an abstracted image of nature that I find really fascinating.
And you had that when I first saw it, you had a printout that was
we put it up at
6 feet or 8 feet long or something like
that. Well, it's been printed up to 40 feet. We had a 40 foot long version of it at SIGGRAPH in the lobby.
It was huge,
probably 6-7 years ago.
Yeah,
and that was
let people know, I'm talking about a 40-foot long photograph, which you can go right up
at
to
300 dpi.
At 300 dpi.
Yeah, that
40
long.
Feet long at 300 dpi.
Yeah, so we love big prints. So we love this stuff. So, you know, HP gave us a big 60-inch printer that Chris is sitting right next to.
Yeah.
So that it's just fun to see that much detail expressed at large, because when you drill down on a gigapixel image online, you're not observing all of it at once. You know, it's kind of cool, but you're not overwhelmed by the amount of detail like you are in a big print.
Right.
So that's been fun. And we did the first gigapixel photo show, I think, in Oslo, Norway, about 4 years ago, when we used to run Digital Storytelling, which is a great conference that I used to put on with Kim Larson.
Oh, right.
And,
well, Kim, I've been talking to.
Yeah.
He's awesome. Yeah. And we've been talking VR with him.
He's totally bitten by it.
I love Kim. He's a great, great guy.
Oh, yes. Great collaborator.
So, all right. The Yosemite story is fantastic, but you've got this venture has brought you to many other cool places. So name some of the other amazing places you've been to to be able to take some incredible photographs.
Well, last year was a good year. I can talk about those projects now. So we basically had two really, really fascinating projects last year. The first one was temporarily was with, we were approached by an arts curator from the state of New Mexico, and they had just bought a dome theater. So we've ended up doing a lot of work in full dome and planetarium dome. And if you're not familiar with that, there is quite a subculture that exists in the dome world. And so planetariums, they used to have the old Zeiss Starball projectors. Those have been retrofitted with digital blended projectors, and so now it's all digital projection, digital planetariums, and they have real-time star universe simulations that are just astounding, UniView and Digital Sky and the like. So, if you're not familiar with that world, it's a great world for a CGI artist to work in, by the way. Not a whole lot of funding there, but some great work and people. So it's been our little sandbox for a number of years
My
now.
wife, actually, that was her first foray into CG,
Oh,
was
yeah.
to work in the at the planetarium in
Oh,
Houston.
in Houston. Oh, I know that woman down there.
And so yeah, and so they were doing the first project she worked on, it was a full 3D project, was something called Alien Worlds, which was
I think I remember
rendered
when
in
she
Bryce.
worked on that. That was before we were doing Full Dome, I think. Yeah,
Oh
that's right. That's when you
yeah.
first
It was
moved
a
out here.
painful thing.
Yeah, that's right. That's interesting. So, but yeah, so this, so to go back to last year, they the state of New Mexico purchased a geodesic dome from our friend Ed Lance here in LA, and he or they bought it as part of the 2% for Arts Fund. So the idea is that there's a temporal land art program called TIME. And I forget the acronym for that, but it's a land art type of temporal installation, I think. But in any case, so Eileen Brazil is the was our client on that, and kind of the producer. And so she's out of Santa Fe. But anyway, long story short is she has always involved Native American artists in this and tried to put Native American artists on equal stage with Western artists, let's put it that way, on a fine art stage. So whether it's New York or Europe or what have you. So that's her big goal, or her career goal. So she had enlisted a great artist named Burt Benally, who's a Navajo artist that works a lot with fire as a temporal thing. And I think he had done another piece for her earlier. But again, these are one single night events that take place, and they bring a crowd out to remote areas of New Mexico on Navajo land, generally where non-natives don't generally tread, and experience Navajo culture. So this time around, she set it up, but she invited Ai Weiwei, the great Chinese dissident artist. And Weiwei responded and accepted. So that he would collaborate with Burt Benally, this Navajo artist. So, and anyway, and then on top of that, they bought this dome. So they wanted a dome film that documented and interpreted this collaboration between Weiwei and Burt Benally. So it was just this very fascinating project. So we started by going out to New Mexico and documenting, and we had just gotten into UAVs. I guess drone now has stuck as a term. But so we purchased our first UAV at that time for photogrammetry. And we carry up, we got a 3D robotics unit that's it's kind of in between the heavy lifters and the Phantoms. And this can carry the Sony A7 right here, which is a 36 megapixel back. So we
Yeah, but
wanted
it's light,
something,
right?
yeah, well, a little bit. It's right on the border what this can handle.
Right.
But we did that because we didn't want to use GoPro, footage or stills. We wanted something really high resolution. So we've now got this going, and we did some R&D on this, and now we're getting 36 megapixel mapping recreation of landscapes with this. So it's been a great thing. So we did our first project with it out in New Mexico in this really remote canyon, Coyote Canyon, which was just an amazing location. And then and basically built a giant digital model of it for this dome film. And as a matter of fact, when we're done here, Chris, I'll show you the film on the headset because we
Okay,
have that
cool.
in VR too.
Awesome.
And then, but anyway, and then we worked with the Navajo artists and, told stories over campfires out in this amazing place. So it was a great way to learn more about the Navajo and kind of what goes on out there. And again, we do a lot of cultural heritage work with archaeologists and so forth here in X-Rays, and it was just another kind of dimension of working with cultural heritage projects, sure. Which we find really rewarding. Very little budgets, but very rewarding anyway to do this. So that was great. And then we ended up traveling to Beijing and meeting with Weiwei in his office, which was just an amazing opportunity. And he's quite the legendary character, as you may know. Mm-hmm. And so that was quite fascinating. I did photogrammetry of him.
Wow.
So we have a little 3D model of Weiwei. And we did Kinect capture also. So we carry the Kinect 2 with us wherever we go as well. And then, so that was great. And then we created the film for a number of months. And it premiered, I think, in July of last year in Santa Fe at this Dome installation. And it's now screened at Art Basel and is continuing to screen at different art events at different places. And it was also an interactive installation in the Museum of Contemporary Native American Art in Santa Fe. So we did a big iMac with a touchpad and did kind of a neat little installation of it. So you could kind of spin the camera, spherically.
That's cool. I'll tell my dad. My dad lives in New Mexico now. So
oh, does he? Okay.
He lives in Albuquerque.
Yeah. Oh, great. Oh, yeah. So that was really terrific. And then that was also matched at the same time by doing a lot of work for Andy Wang, who's actually a student of mine from the SC program, who's done a lot of work with Bjork. So he called us up and he said, I'm working on Bjork's new album and film. Actually, it's an installation at MoMA in New York that's open right now. And there's a 12-minute film that's more than a music video, and but it's this kind of ambitious piece. And it's a very, heavy content. It's about her divorce and separation, all this. But she wants to do a dome theater in MoMA, and she wants to do digital landscape, and she wants to do VR, and you're doing all those things, so can you help? Wow. Well, of course, the answer is yes. So we ended up having a terrific trip over in Iceland working with her and the crew. So we crewed over there and did, and actually you can see up there is some of the images from that trip.
Oh, right.
And that was a really memorable experience the last year. And then we took a week off after the shoot, and we did some amazing captures of her with the Kinect, et cetera. But then our old ally, Olafur Haraldsson, local there in Reykjavik, took us on this trip, and we got to see just some amazing backcountry things and documented those with photogrammetry and laser scanning. We had Autodesk Faro scanner, et cetera. So we've got some incredible assets from that.
Right.
So, quite a stunning trip. And I plan on returning many times there.
Right.
So that was great. And so in the end, that was all used. All that was used for the film and for two videos, or at least one that Andy's done from the album too.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been pretty terrific. Those are two very oddball kind of projects. And
saying that like everything you do is going to be a unique experience. So you're never going to have the same experience twice, right?
Yeah, that's right. Which, as long as the phone keeps ringing, that's the main thing.
Well, the phone has been ringing, right?
No, it does.
The thing is like everyone's got, I got another weird idea.
Oh, yeah. No, I had a great call this morning and we've got probably four or five irons in the fire on things that we're up to. And one big shift we're making, though, is that we are kind of shifting a bit away from service and more towards IP. So we're actually doing a film development now. And we have all kinds of VR content ideas that we're pursuing with the rise of VR. So we really, and that's, it's the ultimate, the foregone conclusion that any
everything content. You're doing is definitely geared towards a VR experience, right?
Yeah.
You guys like, oh, you know what? I'm going to go to the Himalayas, which you guys have done. You guys went to base camp and in front of Mount Everest. You shot some incredibly high detail stuff there. Now someone can put a VR headset and experience it as close as possible.
Funny you say that. That's our first title that we're doing is Everspace Camp Trek. So we're taking all that content and bundling it up in an interesting narrated journey.
Yeah,
kind of highlights.
Well, I think it's really, really cool that they're doing that because, like I said, you guys have been to Everest, you've been to Iceland. You can go to all these places and then people can experience them. And VR makes perfect sense. Which is what I experienced here. I mean, to put it in perspective to those who can't see where I am, but I'm sitting in Eric's office at X-Res, which happens to be at the Santa Monica Airport, And there's just nothing but camera gear everywhere. As far as I can see, there's camera bags everywhere. There's some grappling rope over there. There's a printer that's bigger than, you know, you can ever imagine. There's a drone, which you call a UAV, which is now called
a
drone.
We like stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Hiking poles, pickaxes. Yes. It's kind of crazy, which is exactly the way I've always remembered Eric.
You always will.
I used to go, because your office was in the, are you still living in the same place?
I'll have a titanium walker 20 years from now, I guarantee. I'll have the coolest walker around.
Because you used to live in the same house? You still
Yeah.
And so your office was in the back in the garage area.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
And used to go hang out in the garage. And it's like, it's got some cool. I'm like, my brother gave me this Mac. He just handed me it down, and I'm going to use it for this. And it's like, there's always something that you were tinkering with and playing
that's
with.
That's right. Well, you know, that does take toys. I mean, it does take gear doing what we do.
Yep, absolutely. And so it's kind of cool that you actually turned all of that fun hobby into not only just a job, but like something really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I say, I think the lesson there is that I would say is don't wait so late to combine all of your passions into one.
Yeah.
So, cause like I say, I always had kind of two sides of my life, you know, and then, and it was so fun to kind of finally go, wait a minute, what was I thinking?
Right.
I can fuse this together. And this is the thing that I always talk about in CGI is that why does 99% of most students and artists do demonic creatures? It's like it's a big world. There's, you know, CGI by its nature is just a pencil, right? So anything you want to create, and that's one thing that you know.
Now
like the older I get, the more fascinated I am by all these myriad of things in the world. And that's the other kind of thing that I did was I used to build fantasy cities and fantasy, you know, creations.
Yeah.
And I mean, I still love all that. It's like once a designer, always a designer, but at the same time, it's like, I'm finding myself more just totally fascinated by the real world and the magical, you know, locations that exist here.
Yeah.
So that's why we're all about trying to capture that stuff digitally and replicate it and modify it, I should say. If you saw one of the demos on that reel was taking what are 3 foot tall, they're called sand tufas at Mono Lake, but creating this kind of majestic, ginormous, you know, scene out of it. So we're finding that photogrammetry affords a lot of great fantasy kind of concept art, you know, experiences too, especially in VR. So that's been... because in stereo in VR, of course, it's all about scale. So you can kind of fool a person to think a small thing is large or vice versa.
Right.
So that's kind of neat. But anyway, long story short is you can build anything. You can create anything in CGI. And why does it have to be what we see all the time? It's like it could be any myriad of things.
I mentioned that exact same thing on one of my other podcasts. I was like, you know, like it's like you know, ZBrush, amazing modeling tool. And what do you get? You get a monster, the same monster every time. Like, why are you keep doing that? Because you keep following the same tutorial or whatever it is. And it's there's other ways to do
it. And the thing about demonic creatures, I mean, I don't have anything innately against it. It's just not my thing. But I've never seen a demonic creature that scares me either. If I saw one frightened me, maybe
they did it, it's like the creature from Alien. Holy crap, scared everyone.
Yeah,
but now everyone does the exact same creature to the point where it's just comical.
Yeah.
It doesn't even look, whatever. It looks the same.
It's just, it becomes, you know, whatever.
It's so disappointing. That was the thing, when 8mm came around and it was like, oh, that's so scary. Never saw it until I was like, oh, crap, it's the same monster again. Mm-hmm. So, I know what you mean.
Yeah, so there's a lot of room for innovation and I think is the lesson, but... I think, you know, CGI, well, the other thing is, I mean, I teach in the film school at SC and kind of oversee the visual effects curriculum there and built up a bunch of courses. And the thing I tell students there, because students have a tendency to kind of want to tell their own story, whether it's a troubled upbringing or something in their life or what have you, which, you know, is kind of the natural thing. But, what I usually say to try to break them out of that spell is I say, walk out of this building, chart a vector, just close your eyes and hold your finger out some direction, walk until you hit a building, walk into that building, introduce yourself, find out what goes on, and you just might find some remarkable story, because SC is a big research university. Mm-hmm. So there's, you know, to this day, I've been teaching there probably 9 years now, 10 years, but to this day I'll discover things that I had no clue went on that are just absolutely mind-bogglingly incredible. And right. You know, this just, it's just staggering. So there's so many stories to be told in the world, you know, and it's not about what a lot of CG artists think it is, yep. You know. And so and that's another reason I've kind of moved on past features, is I kind of felt like I was starting to tell the same stories or work on similar stories over and over again. And it's like I'd rather kind of discover new things in the world.
Right.
So that's the other interesting thing. And CGI is perfect for it. I'll tell you, I mean, that's everything we do. The downside of the upside is just about anything can benefit from working with visual effects and CGI. The sure. downside is it doesn't exist. So we have to educate or inspire, or, you know, we have to kind of pry open the doors that we knock on.
Right.
So they're, you know, people, if people don't use effects or CGI in what they do, why would they? Now, of course, in archaeology, it's clear, right? That cultural heritage, it's clear that CGI brings a lot to the table, scanning and documentation.
Sure.
But a lot of these cases are just, they're, you know, but that's where creativity comes in, because you're applying it to an area that's never been applied to.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore the funding may not be there. So you have to get creative about where that funding may come from.
Right.
You know, so that's the other trick about this. And that's why we don't see a lot of other people moving alongside us, because, you know, because there's money's not dropping down out of the trees.
No.
But at the same time, if you're clever about it and you're creative in what you find, I think there's always things to support you, to support your work. So it's just a function of, but it's not like hanging a shingle to do visual effects against the next guy.
Right.
You know, it's just like, what can you do with effects from a creative level to work with really interesting people? And that's the other, it goes back to people again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we end up, you know, working with I wouldn't have worked with Weiwei or
sure
Bjork or whatever had I stayed in architecture. So
yeah.
You know, it's fascinating who you may come across if you just kind of take a different road.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's, and don't be shy to try new things also, you know?
Yeah, sure.
And just to say, you know, like, hey, I like hiking and I like taking photography and I have a real passion for this stuff. There's no reason why you can't turn that into a successful job. It's not that mm-hmm. different. And,
yeah, right.
And apply it. Yeah. I think the creativity almost comes from the fact of you thinking, it's like, what could I do with this? And then look at you, here you are. You've got an office, you've got everything
yeah.
else going on. So
yeah. And with the advent of VR looming like it is, I think it bodes really well. As
yeah.
I say, this is kind of like, you know, 20 years ago all over again, as far as, except that now I'm a little older and more tired.
Right.
And, but nonetheless, no, there's so much incredible opportunity coming.
Yeah. And in fact, you guys have done so much so far that you guys are also ahead of the curve. It's like, oh, I've got the content to put onto these VR headsets, you know?
Yeah, we have the content, but we're trying to be clever about how it's used. And it's, again, it's what we've done for Full Dome. We're just completing the sphere. So it's
right.
The difference is stereo. So now there's a lot of, you know, we've had to deal a lot with stereo issues, and we just finished our R&D on a live action stereo capture with embedded talent. Stereo talent, and that's mm-hmm. we've got some good stuff going there, but that's because there's no camera solution out there that's worth its salt yet
mm-hmm.
For stereo spherical. Greg did a great presentation recently where he had a Venn diagram of three spheres and three overlapping spheres. One of them was spherical, one was full motion, and one was stereo mm-hmm. and it's easy to combine any two of those, you know, it's mm-hmm. relatively straightforward. But if you try to combine full motion, stereo, spherical, doesn't exist. It's, mm-hmm. it's a huge science project, and everybody's trying to crack it. Whoever cracks it first is going to be, you know, have a nice bank account. So it's mm-hmm. There's a lot of money that's floating around to try to develop it. But anyway, so that's one reason that we take our work through Maya, is we get great lens shaders like the Hazelton mm-hmm. shader that we talked about is just so useful. And so we get a just a beautiful optical resolution and stereoscopy mm-hmm. Natively from native 3D, as opposed to try to capture it optically with all the problems that
So has. You process the stereo part after you've already had the
No, it's part of the lens shader, so it's part of the render.
Yeah.
But it's left and right eye, so the Oculus or the Gear, you know, needs two separate eyes.
Yep.
So, but there's going to be so much growth and, you know, in all this. So we started with the very first Oculus DK1, but, you know, kind of thought it was cute at first. It's like, well, it's kind of neat, you know, it's probably got a future to it. And then as the DK2 came out, thought, all right, well, now it's starting to get somewhere. And now with the Gear, and of course, having seen the Crescent Bay, you know, it's just absolutely stunning what's ahead. Mm-hmm. So it's just to see where it's come in the year and a half or 2 years has been rather remarkable. So if we go forward another 2 years from now, it's just going to be just staggering.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's really exciting. So we're having a blast, you know, just investing in VR right now, or just kind of putting our efforts into it.
Yeah. Well, that sounds really cool. I'm probably running a little bit out of time, but I wanted to ask you real quick, can you tell people what you're going to be talking about at FMX?
Okay. So at FMX, I think I'm in Alex McDowell's session.
Yeah.
I'm still actually trying to figure out the exact structure of what he has set up there. If you go to the website, it says transmedia. I could be wrong. But I think I'm speaking with someone else from the World Building Lab, and actually I forget now who the panel is. The panel has a bit of an obscure title, and this was kind of news to me when I landed in on it, but it has something to do with a sense of time and presence in either virtual worlds or in created worlds. Like, how do you establish a sense of a moment in time, like the moment, the now, existing in virtual time? So that's what, I mean, I'll try to talk a little bit about that, perhaps. But, yeah, I'm curious to see what everyone else will discuss.
Yeah, it'll be cool, because actually I'll be there as well, obviously. So yeah, we'll be hanging out and drinking some beers in Germany for sure.
Oh, yeah. Talking about the moment in time.
Yeah, the moment in time. the now, exactly. So, yeah, I'm excited about it. I've never been to – have you been to FMX before?
Not.
Yeah, I mean, I'm neither. So I'm really excited to see that experience. I've heard nothing but good things about that event. So I'm excited to find out. All right. Well, we're going to let the last packet drop, because it's going to run too long otherwise, because I know you and I can talk for hours.
Yeah, we'll keep going.
But yeah, it was good. Thanks a lot, Eric. I appreciate it.
All right. My pleasure, Chris. Great to see you, and we'll chat again.
Yeah. All right.